From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, this is Dakota Midday for Thursday, August 18th, 2011. I'm Kara Hetland, and sitting in today for Paul Guggenheimer. And we're broadcasting today from Eros Data Center near Sioux Falls, where a team of scientists who are working on the next imaging satellite being sent into space have been meeting all week. They're called the Landsat Science Team. It's a group of about 20 national and international science leaders who are providing scientific and technical input to the USGA and NASA on issues that affect the use of the Landsat series of satellites. These are satellites that help scientists understand the changes in land and water across the globe. And we'll talk with some of the lead scientists about the latest findings all this hour on Dakota Midday. First, this news. And welcome to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Kara Hetland, filling in today for Paul Guggenheimer, who is on vacation for a week. And we are broadcasting live from the Eros Data Center near Sioux Falls. Joining me at the broadcast table are three scientists. And we will be talking with all three of them throughout the hour. You can call in your questions or comments to 800-524-3604, 800-524-3604, or send an email question to midday@sdpb.org. So now we'll introduce our guests. We're going to go one at a time and tell a little bit about yourself and what you do with the Landsat project. So first up is Tom Loveland. He's the senior research scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey at Eros. Welcome to Dakota Midday. Thanks for having us here.
Well, great. Thanks, Karen. We're all delighted to be here. I've been a part of Eros for the past 30 years. I'm actually a native of the region, grew up in Sioux Falls, went to school around here. Got started at Eros in the late 1970s because of this new technology called remote sensing and Earth observation satellites. Over the years, my work has been involved in trying to understand the characteristics of changes in the land surface around the globe and across the country. And right now, I'm serving as the U.S. Geological Survey co-chair of the Landsat Science Team, and I do that with a colleague from NASA.
Okay, and Curtis Woodcock, who is a professor of geography and environment at Boston University. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, thanks so much. Nice to be here in Sioux Falls. I'm not quite sure what to tell you other than I've been using satellite remote sensing since I was an undergraduate in college back in the late 1970s, sort of like Tom's referring to, and have used it to study forests primarily, but also all different kinds of growth of cities and the spread of agriculture in new areas and things like that, from places from China to Egypt to Turkey to right here in the U.S. And so I've had a great deal of fun using satellite imagery for a long period of time.
Okay, great. Thanks for being here. And Jeff Masick, did I say that right, Masick?
Pretty close, yeah.
Is it Masick?
Yeah, that's
Masick.
Right.
Okay, sorry, Jeff. Jeff Masick is a NASA Landsat project scientist. Tell me what that is and where you're based.
I'm based at Goddard Space Flight Center, mm-hmm. which is just outside of D.C., and Landsat is a partnership between USGS and NASA. NASA is typically builds and launches the hardware. And we also use a lot of the science data for science analysis. So part of my job as project scientist is, they say, ensuring the integrity, the scientific integrity of the mission. So that comes down to worrying about things like calibrating the data, the geometric accuracy of the data, and so forth. My background's actually in geology. I started using Landsat data back in grad school as a geologist, and gradually have sort of shifted around to worrying about things like land cover change and terrestrial ecology, and then I came to NASA in 2001, and I guess since 2009 I've been the Landsat project scientist.
Okay. Now let's just talk, give a little reminder, a little history mm-hmm. of what the Landsat project is, and then we'll move into the launch coming up.
Very good.
Later.
Project Landsat was actually an idea conceived in the mid-1960s, and it came about when a couple of visionary leaders in the federal government at the time, Stuart Udall, Secretary of the Interior, and Bill Pecora, the director of the U.S. Geological Survey, recognized that the emerging use of space for monitoring the land at that point, because of defense and intelligence interests, had merit in taking a look at issues more relevant to civilians, improving natural resources management from a space perspective. Pecora and Udall successfully pitched the idea. NASA stepped forward and took the leadership in developing the first satellite, Landsat-1, which was launched in July of 1972. And so that's when the Landsat era really began. Eros was established in South Dakota at about that time, and we moved into our facility now just north of Sioux Falls in 1974. And our longstanding role has been to serve as the stewards of the data. We archive and distribute it to audiences, to users worldwide. Now, it's almost 40 years later. We've had six successful Landsat launches since then. Two are still operating. Surprisingly, one is a satellite called Landsat 5 that was launched in 1983 with a three-year expected design life. And here we are approaching the 27th year, and it's still working. Mm-hmm. Our second satellite that's still in orbit and collecting imagery around the world is Landsat 7, which is about 12 years old. And so, you know, we've built this incredible, continuous, unbroken record of the globe. Nothing like it is in existence. It's the most definitive record of the changes or the conditions of the of our planet that's ever been created. And for that reason, we want to see it continued. And so one of the topics we're talking about this week is how ready are we for the launch of the next Landsat satellite, the Landsat Data Continuity Mission, which will be called Landsat 8 upon launch.
Yeah, and Landsat 8 is being more designed here, right, by Aero? I mean,
we are designing the ground system for Landsat 8 at Aeros. That's a USGS lead, but the primary mission leader is NASA, and they're responsible for the overall mission success and the space segment.
Okay, so Landsat 5 and Landsat 7 circle, mm-hmm. right? The Earth and take pictures continuously,
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And how many before it comes back? How long does it take to take
it? It takes any individual satellite 16 days to fly back over the same area. So an image acquired today would be for this area, for Sioux Falls, would be repeated 16 days later. Now, because we have currently two satellites in orbit, their orbits are sequenced so that we actually have the potential to acquire an image every 8 days.
Okay, and is there a difference in imaging technology between the 5 and the 7?
There are slight technological differences, but fundamental data characteristics are about the same.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
There will be a change with the Landsat Data Continuity Mission. We've added two extra spectral bands, which helps us discriminate different types of materials on the surface. Mm-hmm. And we've also improved the radiometry quite a bit. In other words, the accuracy with which we can tell the brightness of any particular spot on the ground has become a lot better. So Landsat 8 is now in the testing phases, actually. It's being integrated. We have industrial partners. Ball Aerospace is building the instrument called the Operational Land Imager, or OLI. And Orbital is building the spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And so right now, those two pieces are being integrated. And we're going to launch next year, December 2012. So 2012 is kind of a big year for Landsat, mm-hmm. because it's the 40th anniversary of the program. And then in December, we get our new satellite up.
The new satellite goes.
That's right.
But you will be able to tell a significant difference, do you think, between images from 7 to 8? Is that?
They should be a bit better.
A bit better.
A bit better.
Clearer. Okay. And as a user, Curtis, of the images, I mean, is it, describe what it is that you look for, what you see when you see these images.
Well, there was a, if you want to think of it in sort of broad time periods, the initial sort of rush that comes with having satellite imagery is that you can do things like make maps of natural resources in ways that were just not even possible before, because you can sort of see big areas all at one time, and the data's in formats that allow you to do computer analysis of it rather than having to stick to kind of old-fashioned air photo interpretation and that sort of thing. And so there was a long stretch of time where we really just kind of tried to pin down what was where on the surface of the Earth, and the use of the satellite imagery was great for doing that. More recently, and maybe the last 15 years sort of, it's really how the Earth is changing has come to dominate what we use the satellite imagery for, because you can watch the world change. You can see where people are doing what. You know, we're cutting down forests here. We're building new cities here. We're, you know, so it's this whole ability to kind of track and monitor the planet that is so remarkable and so related to having repeated observations over long periods of time. We know what it used to look like. We know what it looks like now. We can start to figure out what happened in the intervening time. So it's a little bit like being an investigator. You know, what happened? You know, you can start to try to figure out and track what's going on around the planet. And you can't really look anywhere without finding change. Everywhere in some way or another is changing, and so there's this constant sort of flow of interesting questions that go on.
And then are you able, by seeing change in one place and seeing, you know, maybe later change but similar change in another place, then can you predict consequences?
Sure. One of the big steps in this whole process, you know, seeing it change is important. That's the first step. But then, you know, why did it change? And how does it matter, or does it matter that it's changed? Those are all the related questions. But being able to actually tell when, where, and how things have changed at a very fundamental level is what the satellite data itself is used for.
Should there be an effort then to prevent change?
That's a good provocative question.
It depends on the kind of change.
It depends on where it's occurring and that sort of thing. Uh-huh. There, for example, there's a lot of illegal logging that goes on around the world. And if you can tell people where that's occurring, they can go about the process of trying to rein in illegal logging. And there are programs to do that currently in Brazil, for example. Indonesia started trying to do that sort of thing. So it's a good question.
The other interesting thing about a 40-year record is it starts to be long enough so you can see the tides of economics and social change, you know, imprinted on the landscape. You know, there's been studies, for example, about looking at the fall of the Soviet Union and agricultural abandonment in the former Soviet republics. So, you know, there's a big economic change, a big social change, which then has a consequence on the landscape. You can actually chart year by year how that plays out. So that kind of, you know, in a way, it's like looking at an experiment over the last 40 years of how economics and policy has made a difference in terms of land cover and the Earth system.
And what are the consequences with that land change there?
It varies. I mean, in various places you see, you know, when you take out the state as the primary player for agriculture, for example, some unprofitable fields are abandoned. You know, it's a big economic disruption when the Soviet Union fell. And so there is a substantial imprint of people just abandoning agriculture and then coming back, you know, as the economic system sort of restored. So, but that all gets charted out in the satellite record.
And if we look at what we've learned from mapping change across the United States using the Landsat record, you know, one of the things that comes through pretty clearly is that change is a fact of life. It's very important. In fact, changes in land use is an important part of our economy. We change the land to increase the output and the profits that put money into communities. So it's a very important thing. We also want to use our land wisely. And so we have policies that enter into the picture that provide incentives for individuals to make changes in how they manage the land. A great example of it that we've certainly tracked carefully with Landsat are the changes in agriculture that have occurred since the mid-1980s to the present. And if we remember back to the Farm Bill from that era, we had the establishment of the Conservation Reserve Program that provided incentives to landowners to set aside lands into either grasslands or forests, depending on the part of the country, as a way to improve conservation and environmental quality. And so there's a case where an economic decision is made with a policy incentive to do things. And satellite imagery, because we're looking at the entire globe, the entire country, all the time, gives us a chance to understand those pulses of policies that do occur.
Were you going to add something, Curtis?
Oh, I was going to just add something to the comments Jeff was making about sort of the implications at times of of big changes like the collapse of the Soviet Union and that sort of thing. And sometimes they have some interesting sort of unanticipated sort of effects. And when we talk about the globe, we often worry about deforestation as one of sort of the bigger environmental issues. One of the big effects of the abandonment of agricultural farmland in Eastern Europe and parts of the old Soviet Union have been the expansion of forests. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there's two sides to sort of all these issues and coins. And really, it's the data that is the final arbiter of all this, that you can actually track these things and get answers to them rather than have to speculate as to what these things might occur. That was all.
And Tom, tell me, how many images come in every day to Eros from these two satellites?
We acquire about 350 to 380 per day from Landsat 7 and around 200 a day from Landsat 5. And so we're adding significant volumes of digital imagery every day. And, of course, since we've been doing this since the early 1970s, we're sitting on a very, very large archive. I think the estimate right now is that we have we're just closing in on the 3 millionth Landsat scene that's in our archive in Sioux Falls, which, again, is an incredible record. One thing, and I think we've seen during our time with the Landsat science team that perhaps is one of our proudest moments is that in December of 2008, at the urging, because of strong evidence by the science team, the USGS made the decision to make all Landsat data available to anybody in the world at no charge. And let me tell you what the outcome of that was. When we were selling Landsat imagery, our biggest year was about the distribution of about 2,500 images.
A year?
Per year.
Okay.
In the first year of free data, we distributed over 1 million. We hit about almost 2.5 million the second year, and then the third year we're going to probably come close to hitting 3 million. Those images have been sent to over 181 countries. That might make Landsat one of the largest exports out of the state of South Dakota. And it's revolutionizing the way people are able to understand changes of the Earth and manage those changes. So it's just a remarkable step forward.
Before the internet, though, did people have to physically come here to look at images or put in a mail order request, or how did it work?
The early days were mail order requests.
Mail order.
And in the early days, we send photographs of the images rather than the computerized information we distribute now. We evolved into sending big computer tapes. We evolved into sending CDs and the like. And now we send no electronic media. Everything's done over the internet.
And people can just log. I mean, they can access and take and zoom in and.
Yes, anything in our archive you can view in advance through one of our image browsers, or and if you like it, you click order and it will be prepared and for you to download to your computer.
The other aspect of that free data is that it really leads the way for other space agencies to follow suit and. You know, we're hoping that happens because there are other satellite systems up there now from other countries that are like Landsat in some ways. Some of them have different capabilities. But what we'd really like to see is that they all follow USGS's lead and make their data available for free, because then you'd see a huge synergy across these different systems.
And then you can compare? I mean, would there be different kinds of images to compare with?
Well, sure. For example, one thing Tom said is that Landsat acquires data every 16 days. That's great, but what you'd really like sometimes for some applications is data every 2 or 3 days, right? So if you've got a satellite from India and a satellite from the European Space Agency and Landsat, you can put those all together. You can get that. But right now there are some issues with that because other space agencies don't allow their data to be distributed.
Imagine if you wanted to monitor the health of the crops in your field, and you have a satellite that, well, we have two, so they would go over every 8 days, but it's cloudy some of the days, and so you don't get the observations necessarily every 8 days, and so pretty soon all of a sudden it's been, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months, and you haven't had the observations that you need to do it. But if you could use all the data from these other satellite systems from other countries, and combine them in a productive way, then we could get it down to a more frequent set of observations, which would make it more useful for some of these kinds of land management applications in particular, where people are worried about the management of their particular particular plot of land for whatever reason.
And in fact, we right before we came in this room, we had a report from one of the science team members from the European Commission. And among the things he reported was the efforts of the European Union to change their space data policies and to start moving to the free model that that we have initiated here. And we're seeing that around the world. There's a move now toward data democracy, to make data available freely for scientific purposes, for natural resources management.
The U.S. has provided leadership in this area of Earth observation since from day one. I mean, you know, we were, from a technological point of view, sort of the only game in town for a long period of time. But there remain these issues that leadership is still required, and these things like data democracy and in essence, making it possible for other countries to get the benefit of the data we're collecting anyway by making it freely available and that sort of thing is still a form of leadership that's needed. And the U.S. continues to try to do that.
And when we come back, we're going to hear more about some of the science that was released this week at your conference and talk more about what's happening with the Landsat satellite system. So you're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, sitting in today for Paul Guggenheimer, and we're broadcasting live from Aeros Data Center near Sioux Falls. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 800-524-3604, 800-524-3604, or send an email question to midday@sdpb.org. We're talking today with Tom Loveland, who is the senior research scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey at Aeros, and Curtis Woodcock, who is a professor of geography and environment at Boston University, and Jeff
Masick
is a NASA Landsat project scientist. Sorry, I will get that before the end of the hour. So thank you. We're going to talk just briefly now about some of the science and some of the research that was talked about this week during is it a conference? Is that what you're calling it? Or
it's a meeting of the Landsat science mm-hmm. team. And maybe I should just give you about a 30-second picture of the team. In order to provide clear scientific and technical input to the things that face the Landsat user community, we convened the team, NASA and the USGS, 5 years ago. To give us good advice. And we started this process by asking for proposals from researchers around the country and around the world for that matter, and we selected 20 individuals. And so, you know, that's kind of the who's who in both the applied and the scientific side, the engineering sides of remote sensing. And so this team represents a real diversity in perspectives, everything from practical issues associated with monitoring forest health to understanding the nuts and bolts of how instruments work and development of new applications that could help in addressing societal benefits. So that's kind of what the team is. This meeting's actually our final meeting for the five-year term, and we will reestablish, we'll recompete this, so we bring in fresh blood and a lot of the current members will continue on with us, and we'll work for another 5 years, and then another 5 years after that. This is a long-term investment that we believe is a significant part of making sure Landsat's relevant to the world.
Okay.
I might point out, Curtis is the elected leader of the team. On our first meeting in January of 2007, we concluded that the team needed a spokesman, someone that could really articulate their thoughts, and somebody outside of government that has the ability to say things that need to be said. And so Curtis, through the confidence of his peers, has taken on that job.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
You're looking forward to it, I can see.
They've been looking for good advice. We've been providing lots of advice. How much would they consider good advice? Well, that's an open question.
We've taken some of it.
And Curtis, did you present at all?
I haven't. Well, I will present later this afternoon on my own individual research. I've presented on some of the topics that the team as a group have been working on, but my research will come later this afternoon.
And give us a hint?
Yeah. Oh, they want to know ahead of time. A hint. Well, it may sound a little bit surprising, but after 40 years of collecting data, particularly since there's new data freely available, we're still finding all kinds of innovative new ways to use that data. And so what I'm going to be presenting on is, in essence, a prototype for what I think ought to be a long-term monitoring scheme done here at Sioux Falls at Aeros Data Center for, in essence, tracking change continuously. As the new data comes in now, it gets processed to a certain level, a very, very useful sort of standard level, and put into the archive, and then anybody else who wants to use the data can come and get it. And Aeros Data Center is kind of like a big gold mine as far as I'm concerned. It's got all the data, and it gets all the new data that comes in. And what really I think makes sense as we go forward into the future is to process that data beyond that traditional level, archival sort of level, to produce a whole new set of products that keep track of where changes are going on around the planet. And so what I'll be presenting on are approaches for doing that that use all the data from the past to try to help you understand what you're seeing now and how it might be changing.
And that would be done here. That's the proposal?
That's the proposal.
And based upon our internal discussions on where we need to be in the next 2 to 3 years, we fully embrace that. That's a challenge we need to take on.
So there would be more interpreting here?
Yes, exactly.
One of the amazing things about seeing the team evolve over the last 5 years is that with the free data and also with just, the increasing computing power, people are using more data for bigger applications. People are doing these sort of dense time series analysis, where they look at changes in forest cover every year from time series. They're also doing continental scale analysis, where they're looking at land cover change over an entire continent. And if you go back, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, just using a few scenes, would tax your computing resources at a university. So it's just amazing to see the growth and how people are using the data.
Because that was one of my questions, is it's so many images. And so do most researchers then pick an area of expertise and just say, okay, I only want images from this spot on the globe and to track it that way?
That's certainly been the history. And because that's all your pocketbook could afford, too. You had to buy the images, and the computing facilities were challenging and that sort of thing. So there's an interesting evolution going on that for a 40-year-old program, it's almost hard to believe that's still the case, but it's changing so fast, and there's such dramatic differences between what we're seeing now compared to what we saw 2 years ago that it's almost hard to believe. It's really fun.
But it must be overwhelming.
It is, in a certain sort of way, but it's exciting. I mean, the opportunities exist now to do things that we never really could have dreamed of before. And so, for somebody who's studying the world and the way it's changing, God, we can actually start to do it now in ways that 10 years ago were sort of off the charts.
Then how do you decide what areas they track here to notice the changes over a period of time?
Well, there's some critical...
Did I stump him?
While he's thinking. there are some well-defined science questions that are out there that, the USGCRP, U.S. Global Change Research Program, wants us to answer, having to do with carbon cycling, water cycling, how fast land cover is changing, deforestation, and so forth. And so, people pick those areas in part based on what the sort of community science priorities are. For example, we have a glaciologist on the science team, and he reported some really interesting results yesterday about some breakup of Antarctic ice shelves. And so, that's kind of a key question is the breakup of the ice shelves and whether the ice flow into those shelves is accelerating. And so that's a well-defined question. He's using Landsat to answer that. So the question comes first, and then the data is sort of suited to answer the question.
Yeah, and we can look at the issue geographically and topically. Certainly, as we look to where we need to be, we need to be looking at the entire global land surface, not just one part of it, but the entire thing. And our primary initial interest is going to have to be on understanding the rates and characteristics of land change, because that's really the point in which things get interesting. If we are changing the surface, we're altering biodiversity, we're changing biogeochemistry, we're affecting local weather and climate. And so just getting a fundamental understanding of the dynamics of change is really an important thing that we need to do first.
And we have several email questions that are coming in. And one, will or were the Aero services used during the Missouri River Basin flooding, will those services change before, during, after? Will the Corps or other local agencies use the data to perhaps alter how they manage the river and plan for flooding?
Yeah,
that's
a very good question. We have been active in providing imagery of the extent of flooding. Our images are showing very clearly the amounts of inundation along the Missouri River, but for that matter in northeastern South Dakota and the James River Valley as well from the spring flooding. I think the real critical part of that question is, are these data being used to understand what the hydrologic issues are much farther ahead of time, so that our predictions of runoff are more accurate? And I think that's a question we need to all get together with the Corps of Engineers to discuss, because obviously we had an unprecedented situation this year where not only snowfall in the mountains, but across the prairies and the Great Plains really was an issue that we may not have had, the best understanding of.
And can you measure through the satellite images, can you really measure a snowpack depth? Can you see that on the images? Is there a way to interpret
not,
that?
Not depth particularly. You can get the area, and the area is often correlated with the depth, especially if you're able to, again, track it in time and see whether it grows or shrinks.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you can't really measure water content?
But getting back to Tom's point about the flooding, that commitment to looking at natural disasters extends internationally, too. I mean, Landsat's been used to look at, for example, the tsunami in 2005 and the extent of inundation from that. And USGS actually has a service that provides imagery in response to natural disasters on a server, so then that's great.
Yeah, we're part of something called the International Charter, in which the space providers, the data
All
providers
of them, right?
around the world,
yeah.
Whenever there's a disaster, will focus their imaging capabilities on the problem and then openly share those data to help deal with the problem. Just one more comment about, we've talked about contributing to monitoring flooding, but, in South Dakota, we have fires in the Black Hills. Landsat's an important part of that process of mapping the extent of those fires, assessing the severity of them, and setting up the remediation practices that help us recover. In fact, we not only do that job, but then we monitor it along with the Forest Service and the National Park Service to understand whether the treatments we're doing to recover from fire are effective, and it gives us a chance to provide feedback to those management actions.
Another email question, with several programs within NASA being refocused, like the shuttle program, is there any major long-term effects to Eros and the Landsat program?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are some concerns about Earth science in general for NASA. All of our budgets are, of course, being squeezed. Mm-hmm. And space missions are expensive. And so there are some larger concerns about how many different types of satellite missions NASA can fly, aside from Landsat. This sort of brings us to the topic of the next Landsat mission after the next one, Landsat 9. And that actually is supposed to be a sea change in terms of the management of the program. Department of Interior and USGS will take the lead in implementing the Landsat 9 program, so they would actually get the money from Congress in order to implement it. NASA would still be involved, would essentially get the contract, if you will, to build and launch the space segment. So the issue starts to become not whether NASA can afford to do Landsat, but how Department of Interior and USGS can obtain the money or afford to do Landsat 9.
So you'll shift.
Yeah, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration independently arrived at the same conclusion that because NASA's focused on new technologies and science, operational programs like Landsat need to be put in agencies with operational duties. And so the recommendation is that it moves to the Department of Interior and USGS, and, as under the terms Jeff mentioned.
We're in a wacky mm-hmm. situation. I don't know. Mm-hmm. We're at the current time, we have this new satellite that we're building. It'll be launched in 2012. It's got a five-year design life, which is a long design life for a satellite system. And we're already at about at the 40-year time period, and that'll extend us out to, 46-year or something, sort of continuous measurements. But there's nothing in the works at the current time for anything beyond that. And so we're very much up against the possibility of having a gap in time where we no longer are making these observations after all what will have been almost a half a century. It's sort of hard to believe that, you can build into life the use of these satellite images. They're used by many federal agencies in land management. They're used in all different kinds of ways. They're sort of part of life here in our country. But there's no assurance that we'll have future observations out into the future. And so it's a very quirky time that we're up against. We've got this beautiful satellite coming, but boy, it ain't going to last forever. And there's no real substantial plans beyond that for future satellites. And so it's a contentious issue. And there's one kind of unfortunate truth in this whole process, and that is that it takes longer to build and launch a satellite than the actual design life of the satellite. So we need to be building and starting to build the one that's the follow-on, the one that we're going to launch next year, now. We can't be waiting, a few years, because that's just the reality of, it's a real high-tech process to go through building one of these satellites with sensors on it, getting it all sort of perfect, and then launching it. And it takes very careful, long time worth of work to get that ready.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about the future a little bit more as well. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And you're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting today from the Eros Data Center near Sioux Falls. And joining me today at the broadcast table is Tom Loveland, who is a senior research scientist with the USGS at Eros, and Curtis Woodcock, who is a professor of geography and environment at Boston University, and Jeff Masick.
Bingo.
Yay, is the NASA Landsat project scientist. I got it. I wrote down a little thing here.
Good
so
term.
We're good. Okay. And so now we've been talking about the Landsat. We've been talking about the images, some of the science. Basically, though, to summarize the science, it's the proof. It's the proof that things are changing. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yes.
It's the evidence we use. Yep.
It's the evidence you use, and it's the images of what's happening. We do have an email question. Why is Eros in South Dakota?
Good question.
Okay.
It begins with a technical issue. When the program was envisioned, they needed a place in the center of the country that had the ability to track satellites from coast to coast mm-hmm. from a central location, acquire the data. And that resulted in a corridor from someplace in the middle of North Dakota on the I-29 corridor down to about Kansas City. Those are the technical criteria. After that, politics, and particularly friendships in politics, took over. And Senator Munt and a very active Sioux Falls Industrial Foundation got involved and prepared a package that was accepted by President Nixon. And so we are here because of that connection of technical and political considerations.
Okay. Now, we've been talking about Landsat 7, the launch of Landsat 8 coming up in December of 2012, and the design and the discussion of that has been going on for 13 years?
A long time.
A long time.
Yeah. There's a tortuous, history that I won't go into, but...
Before Landsat 7 went up, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. This is the thing about Landsat is The problem is that each satellite is essentially considered individually in the past. You know, there's no long-term program, right, that sort of builds and launches them in sequence the way we do for weather satellites. And so each one becomes its own bureaucratic and political issue. And so each one has to be, obtained independently, essentially.
Can it be independently funded by scientists, by businesses, by groups who value the information?
There are some commercial satellites in space that have been funded privately. They mostly are what we call very high-resolution satellites. They collect the kind of real detailed images that allows you to see individual, cars and that sort of thing. They're used a lot in the news. People see them in the news a lot. You know, anybody who goes into Google Earth can see examples of those in many places. They're also very highly prized by the defense industry, and so there's a big market for selling that sort of thing in the defense world, both domestically and around the world. And so there have been examples of success in the commercial domain for those kinds of satellites. They don't. There haven't been commercial successes at broader satellites that are generally used to study the Earth and natural resources and science-supported kinds of things. Those have required the support of governments, and they're collective goods that are served by those, and they're better done in that domain than in the commercial domain.
More reliable as the data itself.
Well,
perhaps,
it's a bad business model to try to live off of the money that scientists have available to try to buy imagery. I guess that's the best way to sort of say that.
It's kind of a question of spatial resolution. You know, if you go onto Google Maps and zoom in all the way, you're typically looking at a commercial satellite image. You know, QuickBird or Iconos or GOI. And those have spatial resolutions of like a half a meter. You can see, you know, your backyard and a swimming pool and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Scientists, I won't say that those data aren't useful. They are useful in very particular applications. But what they really like is to zoom back out a little bit and see a bigger area, even if you don't have that kind of spatial resolution, because then you can sort of look at the landscape scale processes.
And we can see it for longer periods of time and start building the issue of change into the picture. That probably is an important point to emphasize. Landsat satellites have a resolution of 30 by 30 meters. That's about a third of a football field. And so we are not seeing people or cars, but we are seeing fields and regions. And it's not so much a tool for really understanding the detailed activity in an area, but for just understanding the general condition of the landscape and how it's used.
Is there a push, though, to make Landsat the resolution?
No.
No?
We all recognize the value of higher resolution Landsat data, but for the most part, the continuity of measurement that we've had over the years with 30 meters has proven that for monitoring at a global scale, that's a very cost-effective place to be. There are recommendations in other international missions to go to higher resolutions as well. We see real advantages of that for many applications, but Landsat's really, it's that continuity of measurement that ultimately becomes so important. We'll see incremental improvements and probably incremental spatial improvements, but we won't make that big leap to very high resolution. Mm-hmm.
You know, this is one of the fun things that we argue about at these meetings is, you know, what would be the best things to do in the future? Mm-hmm. How could we continue to improve things? And this group has pretty solidly come down on the answer that more frequent observations would be the biggest sort of improvement to the ways that Landsat data could be used. And so that's the big push, is to try to get the observations more frequently to help with the land management issues and that sort of thing.
And what needs to change?
There are a variety of ways that you could try to get to that solution. Mm-hmm. One is that the satellite goes over and looks out, has a certain sort of swath width that it sees at any particular time. Well, future satellites, if it looked further, then you would get a wider area covered and you get more frequent observations. Another approach would be to put up more satellites and in essence stagger their orbits so that you had a different satellite coming over but collecting the same kind of data. That also has a big sort of risk mitigation role in terms of if one of the satellites fails, for example, then the other one would still be up there. And so we're constantly living in this domain where failure is a real possibility, and we could get the whole program clobbered by one unfortunate event.
And that leads to planning ahead.
Exactly.
Planning ahead, but not having any guarantees because of the current political, is that what it is, or the current budget? Or
we obviously are facing budget challenges across the federal government. The euphoria in the Earth observation community occurred in February of this year when the president's budget was made public, and it had a very significant item in there regarding Landsat. It called for making Landsat operational through something called the National Land Imaging Program that would be a part of the Department of Interior and the U.S. Geological Survey that would have a real impact on our activities of AROS. But as important, more important for Landsat users, is the fact that it also called for the immediate planning and development of Landsat 9 with a target launch of 2018.
Yeah.
And also the planning for Landsat 10 for a launch in 2023. That's an incredible step forward. That's really taking the step needed for long-term data continuity. That's the kind of decision that makes the investments that private industry, government agencies, any Landsat user needs to be able to build their capabilities to make most effective use of the data. But as you would expect in a very difficult budget year, it's going to be challenging for that to be approved.
Everybody's nodding. Sadly so.
Well,
so what do you do?
It took years to get to this stage.
Right.
And we happened to get there at the exact same time that we've got, major fiscal problems within the government and the Congress that is going to cut anything and everything it can possibly cut. And so, the House of Representatives has removed it from their version of the budget. We've yet to hear from the Senate. And so it's very much up in the air at this point in time. But it's a culmination of a long period of time to try to get to where we are, and then have it happen on a particular time when everybody just wants to cut everything.
But
it's frustrating.
But as discouraging as that is, the House in their language on Landsat recognized the value and said, "Come back." And so the door's not closed.
And how much longer, though, can you continue to get images from Landsat 5 and Landsat 7?
Landsat 5, we really hope, will continue through the end of 2013, and it will not go further. It will run out of fuel and fall out of orbit. And in fact, every day we wake up and are very pleased to see it still acquiring imagery at 27 nearly years old. That's a miracle.
Wow.
Landsat 7 can operate, 2017.
2018.
But it has some mechanical issues that affect the use, and it is well past its design life as well. So we're really on borrowed time. That launch of Landsat 8 in December 2012 is really critical to the future. But as Curtis explained earlier, getting the planning going now for 9 and 10 is really important.
To some extent, I think we're sort of cursed by the success of Landsat 5. People look at that and say, well, maybe LDCM will last 23, 27 years too. They forget that Landsat 6 lasted about 20 minutes and went into the Indian Ocean, So that does happen occasionally, and then we're really in trouble.
Yeah.
So what's next? You continue to plan, continue to hope, and contact your political leaders to make a decision?
We try to communicate to Congress, for example, at least those of us who don't work for the federal government, what the benefits and the values are. And so we try to provide information as individual sort of citizens, and any organizations that live out there that use the data, they try to communicate these things. And so it's if you use the data, it's helpful to you, let your congressman know.
All right, and we are out of time, and I want to thank all three of you for being on this entire hour and for having us here at Aerostatus Center near Sioux Falls. Special thanks to Joe Telestis, Steve Munson, Severin Ashes, Steve Zwemke, Travis Berg, Jan Nelson, and the great IT staff here who got us connected with 10 minutes to spare. So thank you all so much. Tomorrow, Innovation, we're live from South Dakota State University in Brookings. We'll be talking about a NASA grant that was recently issued to some scientists there. I'm Kara Hetland. For all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, have a great day.